Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I'm in the studio with a guest co-host who is Ricardo Bernal, who's a professor of biochemistry, also at the University of Texas at El Paso. And today we're going to be looking into a subject which is it's central to so many people and it's peripheral to so many people, and it's this concept called intelligent design. As I understand intelligent design, it's basically an offspring from what more people may know of as creationism. And so we're going to have today talking with us Dr. Stephen C. Meyer from the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington, which is an organization which I'll let him explain to you. And so, Stephen, welcome to Science Studio.
It's great to be with both of you. Thanks.
How did you get into this when you were a young man? Was your idea to be an MD or a doctor or a philosopher or, you know, what did you want to do when you were a young boy and how did you sort of develop?
Well, oddly, I was always interested in natural history. As a kid, I was fascinated with dinosaurs and trilobites. And at four, my grandmother sent me a big college-level textbook on paleontology from written by a guy at New York University. And I loved all the pictures and the figures that I could make out. And I remember one time when I was small, I actually buried dinosaur bones in the backyard so I could then bring my friends to dig them up with, well, not dinosaur bones, they were chicken bones, but I pretended that they were dinosaur bones.
No, just little dinosaurs.
Yeah, right, exactly. When I was 10, my sister loves to tell this story. She dies laughing about what a nerd her brother was, but I had collected all sorts of different insects and put little pins in them and identified them, and I was trying to charge other kids in the neighborhood admission to my bug collection. So I had an inauspicious beginning in science, I think you'd say, but at university I ended up double majoring in earth science and physics, but was also interested in philosophy and took a lot of courses on the other side of campus and have been long interested in the issues that are right at the intersection of science and philosophy, and that's kind of been a theme for my work ever since.
Okay, so let's get right in at what you might call the deep end. There is a distinction that I understand, I'm not quite sure I understand it fully, between the older concept of creationism, which I sort of outlined briefly earlier, and the more modern, if I can say, version of this, which is intelligent design. Why don't we let you define these two terms and what it is that your particular interest is today?
Yeah, very good. Let me start with just a simple definition of intelligent design. It's the idea that the complexity that we see in the world is best explained by a designing intelligence rather than an undirected process, such as natural selection acting on random mutation. And the kind of things that we're interested in, the kind of evidence that we see of intelligent design among those of us who are developing this concept are, for example, the nanomachinery that we're discovering in cells, the little miniature machines, the circuitry, and especially the digital code that's stored in the DNA and the complex information processing systems that are at work in the cell to utilize that information. And in physics, we're also interested in what the physicists call the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe and the laws and constants of physics, which many of us also argue it provides evidence of intelligent design. Now, as for creationism, there's a key distinction between actually, two key distinctions. Creationism is really an interpretation of the Genesis chapters in the Bible and a deduction from those chapters about what the world really should look like. Intelligent design is instead an inference from biological evidence. Its starting point is not scripture or church authority, but rather the evidence of the natural world. And secondly, creationism has typically been understood to be an idea that assigns a very young age to the earth, in part because of the interpretation of Genesis that many creationists have adopted. And intelligent design is an age-neutral theory. It's not concerned with the age of the earth. And, in fact, most of us accept the great ages of the earth, certainly I do, that have been revealed by geology. So it diverts from creationism in that it doesn't hold to a young earth, and it has a different epistemology, a different methodology. It's a scientific method starting from the evidence and making an inference back to what might have caused the evidence that we see. In fact, I show in my two books, I'm using the very same historical method of scientific reasoning that Darwin pioneered in The Origin of Species.
Okay, so then if I can sort of make a comment on that, that creationism starts with the book, you know, Genesis and all that, and moves forward. And really what you're saying, that intelligent design is looking where we are now and working backwards.
Exactly.
But then it still seems to us that you will come back to the same starting point, that is, that there was, if we have intelligent design, we must have an intelligent designer.
Right.
So let's start there for a minute. What's your concept of the intelligent designer?
Well, that's really a second-order question that follows from quite a lot of prior scientific reasoning that gets you to the conclusion that a mind of some kind played a role. And people have different concepts of that within the ID research community. I'm a theist myself, so I think of the designing intelligence as Jews and Christians think of God. But others have different ideas, because the science can only take you so far in that. And that's because of the nature of the reasoning that we're doing, or the scientific method that we're using. Darwin pioneered a method that he developed from Charles Lyell, the great geologist, in which he said, if you're trying to explain events in the remote past, you need to look at the cause and effect structure of the world. And the method he used as a name is called the method of inference to the best explanation, or the method of multiple competing hypotheses. And the key question was, well, what makes a hypothesis best? And according to Darwin and Lyell, the best hypothesis is the one that provides a true cause, a cause which is known from our experience to explain the effects in question. So an example might be in eastern Washington, where I went to did my undergraduate work, there's the rolling Palouse country. And if a geologist wanders out into some of the farmland today, you can still find some white powdery ash. If the geologist wasn't there on May 18th, 1980, to see what caused that, he'd have to use this historical method of reasoning. And he'd propose different hypotheses. Maybe it was a flood, maybe it was an earthquake, maybe it was a volcanic eruption. Of the three, the volcanic eruption is the best explanation, because it's the only cause which is known to produce the effect in question, in this case, the white powdery ash. Floods and earthquakes don't do that. And Darwin called this the vera causa, or true cause principle. And we use that same method of reasoning in trying to determine, for example, what caused the origin of the information that's necessary to produce the first life, or to produce new forms of life. And in my book, Signature in the Cell, where I address the origin of the first life question, the issue that's addressed by chemical evolutionary theory, and in my second book, Darwin's Doubt, in both cases I look at a variety of explanations that have been provided or attempted to explain this crucial information-bearing properties of DNA, and argue that those are insufficient for various reasons. But then I turn the corner and say, but there is a cause of which we know that is sufficient to produce information, and that is intelligence.
Okay, so then, you see, that's the big difference from someone like myself who doesn't subscribe to either of these approaches, in the sense that you're coming up to a brick wall, and the brick wall is one that indeed we all encounter daily, and that is ignorance. We don't know. We cannot know everything. All we do as scientists is the experiment. We collect the data. We use our modern instrumentation where appropriate. But we're looking at the experimental data that we can generate, and that we say gives us answers. But at some stage we'll say, but beyond this we cannot go. But that doesn't mean to say that we then fall back on something else. We are still constantly saying, look, there are pockets of ignorance. We don't know how we got from here to there. It's just the same way as if I get a taxi and fall asleep. I know where I started, I know where I'm going, but I don't know particularly the route. But so my point is here that it seems to so many of us that this concept of intelligent design is simply a way of admitting that we are ignorant, and therefore, because we're ignorant, we must generate some cause.
Well, that's a common objection, but let me say two things about it. The first is about the ignorance itself, which I think is actually a very positive thing for us to acknowledge the limitations and the inadequacies of contemporary evolutionary theory. There's a lot of propagandists almost out there, people like Richard Dawkins and some of these new atheists, who convey to the public a very different idea of the status of contemporary Darwinian theory and contemporary chemical evolutionary theory, the former being the theory of biological evolution, the latter being the evolutionary theory of the origin of the first life. And there's the impression given to the public that these theories have accounted for the origin of major innovations in the history of life, like, for example, the Cambrian explosion, which is what my second book is about, or the even deeper mystery, which is the origin of the very first cell. Chemical evolutionary theory for almost 30, 40 years now has been in a state of impasse. And the crucial problem is the origin of the code. When Watson and Crick elucidated the structure of DNA in 1953, they got an idea that the DNA molecule could contain digital information. And in 1957, Crick went further with the advancement of his sequence hypothesis, in which he argued that the nucleotide bases along the spine of the DNA molecule are functioning like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in machine code. And that has proven to be a really fundamental mystery in origin of life studies. No one has been able to explain where the information comes from. Every attempt to explain it either begs the question of prior information or simply ignores the problem.
Well, I tell you, let me interrupt you there. Yep. and bring in the biochemist who, God knows, should know something. No, not God, not God knows. Intelligent design would suggest know something about this.
Yeah, so it's interesting. This idea about digital information in DNA. So what evidence is there for this sort of thing? Because as far as I can tell, and most scientists, it's evolution that determines mutations and therefore function of the product from DNA, which is proteins. So where this digital information comes in, I'm curious about. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, we're not talking about evolution here. We're just talking about the facts of the modern gene expression system, that DNA contains information in a digital form, and it is expressed as it directs the process of protein synthesis.
But it's not digital form, because digital would imply a binary format, right? Of ones
and
zeros.
you can have a four character format as well. It's alphabetic. It's typographic. You have chemical subunits of the molecule functioning as characters in an instruction set. And in the 1970s and 80s, and actually earlier than that, people working in the information sciences started to apply information theory to computing the amount of information that was contained in DNA. And, of course, it's enormous. But in addition to the sort of Shannon information that you can compute, DNA, like a written language or like a section of computer code, also performs a function. So there's a technical term in Origin of Life Studies for this that was coined by Leslie Orgel. He calls it specified complexity. If something is complex, it's highly improbable. Shannon information is inversely related to the improbability of a sequence or a string of characters. But in DNA, like computer code, like human language, there isn't just complexity. The complexity is also specific in its arrangement to function. It's specified. And so that conjunction of a sequence that is specific and complex is something that we argue invariably results from intelligent agency. That's what we know from our uniform and repeated experience, which
is back to the first question
about, are we arguing from ignorance? We're not arguing from ignorance. We're positing another cause, which we know from our experience, our uniform and repeated experience, which is the basis of all scientific reasoning, is always produced by an intelligent agent.
Okay, so let me just interrupt you there, because we've got to take a station break.
Oh, yeah, well, just as it was getting good, right?
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Ricardo Bernal, and our guest today is Stephen Meyer from the Discovery Institute in Seattle. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Ricardo Bernal and Stephen Meyer from the Discovery Institute in Seattle. And you just went through a sort of an explanation about why it is that you can say that there's this directed intelligence somewhere involved in, let's say, the DNA sequencing and the proteins that it produces. And I think Ricardo was going to say something along these, just to sort of make a comment on this.
Well, if we're talking about the complexity of DNA, this is really the result. The complexity comes from the fact that DNA has changed over time. So, I mean, it's not that it was designed at one point and then has remained stagnant, right? It changes over time. And those changes result in more and more complex proteins and products of that DNA code.
Well, we dispute that in two different ways. There are two questions. One is the origin of the DNA protein synthesis system in the first place, which is an absolute precondition to get to the origin of the first life.
I'm going to interrupt, Stephen, because, you know, that comes back to the same thing. That what you're saying there is we do not know something, right? And therefore, you posit the directed intelligence. I mean, that's essentially what you're saying, right? And we would say, well, there are certain things we don't know,
but that
doesn't mean to say we've got to posit anything until we've got more understanding of the system that we're dealing with today. And that's an essential distinction, do you not think?
Well, you gents are throwing several different objections at me all at the same time, so let me tease them apart, okay? The first objection was the one that you raised, which was about, are we arguing from ignorance? What we're doing instead is we're using the standard method of historical scientific reasoning, which is to posit possible causes, to examine their plausibility in light of what we know about cause and effect.
Okay, I like that.
And then to infer that cause, which is known from our experience, to uniquely have the capacity to produce the effect in question.
Okay. If you were to say that this is the way that you're looking at it, then you posit an idea. But then you've got to start to back up this idea with experimental data. You've got to be able to make certain predictions. You've got to be able to, because that's the scientific method I deal with. You know, I have all sorts of crazy ideas in my laboratory, and they're about as good as any other person's crazy ideas until I actually tried to do some experiments, make some predictions. And I think one of the arguments that people who are less inclined to listen to intelligent design as a scientific theory is that we don't see where the experimental part of your area comes in. What is it that you can do experimentally, currently, to sort of somehow back up some of these things, other than new ideas?
Well, there's a whole lot of things that we are and have been doing. In my book, Signature in the Cell, which is unfortunately over 500 pages, I have several appendices and epilogue chapters in which I lay out some of the
predictions. Well, just go through one in about two minutes.
Okay, well, here's one. In the 1990s, the advocates of the theory of intelligent design predicted that the non-coding regions of the DNA molecule, which were at that time understood by the Darwinists and asserted by leading Darwinists to be junk DNA, non-functional sections of the molecule, which were in effect the detritus of the long process of mutation and natural selection, the accumulation of those mutational errors that were discussed a minute ago. But we have been arguing that the information-bearing properties of DNA suggested it was designed by intelligence. So we argued that if our theory was correct, we'd expect to find that the non-coding regions would be largely functional. We do acknowledge that mutations occur, but we didn't think that the signal would be dwarfed by the noise. And so we predicted that the non-coding regions would reveal increasing layers of function. This is actually a prediction that has been borne out by the ENCODE project and other work.
Just for my own interest, who was the person that put this into the literature, this prediction?
William Dembski, Dean Kenyon, Forrest Mims, three different ID proponents. Richard Sternberg, who was acknowledged in the Huffington Post by the very prominent cell biologist James Shapiro in an article that came out after the ENCODE project was published as having been the guy on the forefront of seeing that this function was present. And Sternberg is a prominent ID theorist who was persecuted at the Smithsonian Institution when he published a peer-reviewed article that I had written in 2004. So this is an idea that's intrinsic to ID. There are Darwinists who are still making the argument that ID must be wrong because of the junk DNA. They're not up to speed on what's going on with
Well, even I know that junk DNA serves a purpose, and so it is really out there. And, of course, what you illustrate is indeed, yes, if indeed you are correct, and I'm assuming you are for the purposes of the discussion, that it was people in the movement that suggested that as junk DNA, in fact, had a purpose, and we're beginning to do that. The reason that we've been able to prove this now is through the scientific method. And so it's the scientific method itself. It can never be suspect of trying to foist something because it's constantly changing. I mean, the best thing that a scientist can do...
Well, we're not anti-science. We're with you on this. We've got scientists doing lab work and scientists doing natural history, and the two work together. One tries to explain the facts we already have, but then on the basis of the model or the paradigm you develop, you then develop testable hypotheses that expand your knowledge, and we...
That's an interesting point also, because you've got scientists working in laboratories. But one of the things that is of interest to me is that I'm in the American Chemical Society, and there's an American Biological Society, American Society of Microbiology. They're all over the place. And these are the people, the experts in their particular fields, that demand to have a say in what is taught in that particular subject. For example, if you want a degree in North America in chemistry, then there are schools which have degrees which are authenticated by the American Chemical Society. And one of the reasons that we're doing this program is because you sent a note about time to revisit this famous law case in about 10 years ago in somewhere called Dover, Pennsylvania. So I'd like to get on to that for a moment because we've got a limited amount of time. It'd be very nice to sit down in a bar with you for about 3 hours and wrap this through.
Yeah, it would be indeed. But, we've got a big subject, but we can't cover it all, obviously. But
my point is that scientists in general are not in agreement with this concept of referring back our ignorance to intelligent design. Now, we'll leave that alone.
We dispute that. We're not arguing from ignorance. We're making an inference to the best explanation, which is a proper form of scientific reasoning.
But let's just go to this case about this court case and how it's time to perhaps reinvestigate or reapproach that particular singular decision.
Well, actually, that was more of a PR hook in that the assertion our opponents have made was the debate about intelligent design is over after Dover. The Dover case was an ill-conceived and ill-fated policy. A small district in central Pennsylvania, over our objections, tried to take the concept of intelligent design and impose it as a curricular mandate by telling teachers they had to read a somewhat innocuous statement about a book in the library that discussed intelligent design. One of the people promoting this at the school board level urged the other members of the board to do this in the name of the Crucified One, which was a public appeal to a religious motive, which no court in America was going to uphold. We asked them, please, to withdraw the policy. We didn't approve of mandates and curriculum or trying to justify a scientifically based theory on the grounds of with a religious premise. Okay. They didn't listen to us. Our opponents then, you know, found this to be the basis of some mockery. But what we've been wanting to say is, hey, this debate was not settled by a federal judge. It's not over after Dover. There's a lot of interesting science here, and there's a growing number of scientists who are contributing to this research effort. And we're finding a lot of interesting things that support our point of view.
Let's go one other thing that you mentioned earlier on, some of these little machines. Give your explanation of why these little machines are so important to the cause of intelligent design.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been one of the remarkable discoveries of modern molecular and cell biology, biochemistry in the last 40 years, is that inside even the simplest living organisms, we're discovering these little tiny pieces of nanotechnology. And my colleague Michael Behe made a number of these famous in a book called Darwin's Black Box. You have rotary engines, sliding clamps, little robotic walking motor proteins, the ATP synthase.
Okay. And in fact, I did do a program with Michael years ago. Now, do you want to make some comment? This is now Ricardo Bernal.
Yeah, so it's actually interesting because I've actually worked with the ATP synthase and other very complex molecular machines. And their complexity is indeed very interesting and, as the name implies, very complex. But you can kind of begin to tease how these molecular motors have come about. In fact, some of the proteins, so these are multi-subunit proteins or complexes, some of these proteins that are found in the complexes actually have what are called moonlighting activities. So they have multiple functions, and you can imagine then that these proteins have come from other places and have been put together to make this more complex machine. So there are explanations for how these things came about.
Yeah, this is the co-option idea, and it was proposed as an alternative to, for example, Michael Behe's account of the origin of the bacterial flagellar motor, which is a rotary engine on a miniaturized scale that has about 30 protein parts in the motor itself, another 20 or so that are...
So what's wrong with this approach then?
Well, what's wrong is that it doesn't actually bear scrutiny when you get into the specifics.
But the thing is, it's based on
flagellar
facts.
Well, let me explain some of the specifics because you can't dispute my counterargument unless the basic problem is that the co-opted elements are, for example, in the case of the flagellar motor, they're proposed to be co-opted. They're small subsystems. And you still don't get from the subsystem to the system as a whole through that mechanism. The type 3 secretory system, which is alleged to be the precursor to the flagellar motor. First of all, in mutation density studies, is shown not to be a precursor, but to be an evolutionary byproduct. It's younger, not older, than the aboriginal system, so it can't be the precursor. But in any case, it only has about 10 proteins, and you've got the intermediate stages between the 10-protein system and the 30-protein system are not functionally viable. So,
well, in fact, what we have found in science through experimentation is that a lot of these molecular machines actually function in a very similar manner. For example, the ATP synthase functions very similarly in terms of generation of rotation to the flagella, in that they use the proton motive force. So there's a lot of relationship between these complexes.
We've come to the end of the program, but let me ask you one final question, if I may, Stephen.
Yeah, sure. You bet.
What would it take for you to suddenly wake up in the morning when you read the newspapers or you read, hopefully, the American Chemical Society or American Biological, to say, ah, eureka, they've been able to take me from where I was to understanding that this concept of evolution, as we are talking about it, is indeed correct, and intelligent design is not?
Well, again, we don't dispute evolution as a whole, only the undirected type of evolution that's proposed by the neo-Darwinists.
So devolution has got to be directed, then? That's the bottom line to your stand. Evolution must be directed.
If evolution is to be successful, there would need to be an intelligence. What would be sufficient to convince us otherwise is to see demonstrable undirected processes that are capable of generating the origin of, for example, functional information in DNA or these irreducibly complex miniature machines.
We'd like to have you do this again and start from the end, in a sense.
Yeah, there you go.
There's just not enough time in 28 minutes. But anyway, this is Keith Pannell. Our co-host was
Ricardo Bernal.
And our guest was Stephen Meyer from the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for being there. And we'll be back next week with some other enterprising program on science. Take care. Bye-bye.